Today we have a number of work sessions and a public hearing, two public hearings and two possible work sessions. We will not hear Senate Bill 957 today. We'll not have a work session on that today because there's still some work in progress on that particular bill. And we will start by opening a work session on 157. And Director James Tate, would you come up, please? Did you want to walk us through this? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 157 is a bill that the committee heard back in January, coming back with a set of amendments, the dash three amendments. The committee has a hand and growth version in front of you. If you'd like to look at that. It gives the Home Care Commission some responsibilities of an independent agency, including allowing them to enter into interagency agreements or contracts with the state agency, provide compensation to home care workers who attend appropriate training, and collect fees from persons who attend trainings and are not home care workers, arrange for compensation and health care coverage for home care workers. It also determines the process by which the commission will be funded and specifies that the executive director of the commission will be an employee of DHS. Does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm. Director Tate.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Tate from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disability Program. The dash three amendments, which I think is the hand engrossed version you have before you, I think we've worked out all the details between the department, the Home Care Commission, the Attorney General's office, and all the players here. And again, this is a much simplified bill now, and it just clearly states that the commission is independent in terms of its policy making, but given how the public employee issue was framed in the Constitution, the commission itself will not have staff, but will contract with the department through an interagency agreement for all staffing, budgeting, accounting, support so that it can fulfill its policy mission. And the department director, the governor's office, and the Home Care Commission all would be part of the decision-making and the hiring of the executive director to ensure that that position will support the independent policy direction of the commission. So I believe we've attempted to resolve all the lingering issues from the Constitution as it translated into statute, and I think the dash three amendments do that.
What's the approximate fiscal on this program?
Mr. Chairman, the governor's recommended budget had $158,000 in it, but that was based on an earlier iteration of the bill where we were trying to set the commission up as a hybrid, and it added some accounting staff and some other functions. I believe a new fiscal has been submitted that's slightly higher than that, 158. We're going to have to work in Ways and Means in terms of which, how much of this workload the department simply absorbs versus is funded. The co-chairs zeroed this out, so there's not any amount in the co-chairs budget. So, but if the bill passes, clearly the department will be on the hook for all the admin and accounting contract support to the commission.
Senator Cruz.
No, I could make a comment, but I won't. It would have been relative to the co-chair's budget, but I'll just let that go.
Okay. Okay. Other comments, questions? Okay. Seeing no other comments or questions. Anything else?
No. We'd recommend the due pass, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes.
I move the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 157.
Senator Cruz moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 157. Any questions or comments? So moved.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 157 as amended to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves 157 as amended to the full Committee on Ways, well, to the subcommittee.
No, the full. It's got to go to the full.
Yeah.
and then they assign.
Okay, to the Ways and Means, full committee on Ways and Means, we'll do pass recommendation. Questions? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Durst?
Aye.
Senator Montanderson?
Excuse.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. So fast. Would you like to hand deliver this? I'm kidding.
Anything you want, Mr. Chairman.
It must be getting there. It must be spring because I noticed you got a haircut. So
I'm in Ways and Means this week.
Okay. So you're being shaved involuntarily, is that it? Okay.
Okay, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 326. Would you like to give us an update?
Senate Bill 326 is a bill that the committee's heard twice. We're actually there. I apologize. There's an error on the measure summary, but we're actually up to the -4 amendments.
Okay.
The bill creates the Orthotics and Prosthetics Board of Examiners within the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. The changes that have been made from the -2 since you last saw it, the -4 amendments add references to the Act to other statutes to give OLA the proper regulatory authority. It updates exemption language to give specific exemption to physical therapists and occupational therapists. It replaces the original definitions with definitions from House Bill 2517, and it deletes the podiatric designation from the board and redesignates that seat as one for somebody who is licensed as a physician or a podiatric physician.
Okay.
There is also a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 326.
Senator Cruz moves the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 326. Questions, concerns?
Don't get excited.
Yeah.
You still have one more committee, okay?
None. So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 326 as amended to the full committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves 26 as amended to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Senate Bill 326. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Montanderson?
Excused.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Okay, the bill passes to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. We will we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 617. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 617 requires DHS to establish a traumatic brain injury registry system and to collect data regarding traumatic brain injuries. The committee heard this bill twice. We're now up to the -4 amendments. And the -4 amendments remove sections of the original bill which require DHS to provide housing and mental health services to persons with traumatic brain injury. Simply requires DHS now to contract with a nonprofit, non-government agency with experience in brain injury to provide information and support to brain injury victims, enhance support systems for victims, perform outreach and education to members of the military, victims, and their families, and provide training to community agencies and providers. This bill also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 617.
Senator Cruz moves the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 617. Any objection? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 617 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 617 to the full Committee of Ways and Means.
Yes.
With a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator
Berger? Aye.
Senator Montanderson?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Morissette? Aye. Senate Bill 617 passes to Ways and Means. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 865. Would you give us a rundown, please?
Senate Bill 865 requires the Department of Human Services per approval of a federal waiver to disregard the amount of annual cost of living adjustments for Social Security and Supplemental Security Income benefits in determining food stamp benefits. The committee has before them the -2 amendment, which specifies that DHS will only begin to disregard cost of living adjustment if federal funding is provided.
Okay.
Also have subsequent referral to waiting.
So the dash ones are...
We only need to consider the dash.
Okay, please.
Let me just say that this is the first step. If we get the waiver, we can continue to lobby Congress to send us the money to meet the waiver. The department is under no obligation to use state funds to make up the difference, but I think it's an important first step, and hopefully good things will happen back in D.C.
That would be a first.
That would be, seems to me, 1933, we passed Social Security, didn't we?
And that was a good thing?
That was a good thing. Do you have an amendment? Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendment, Senate Bill 865.
Senator Cruz moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 865. Seeing no objections, so moved. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 865 as amended to the full committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves 865 as amended to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Mon
Anderson.
Excused.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 865 goes to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Are we on?
7.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 754 allows social workers employed by a public body or nonprofit organization providing public assistance to Oregonians to receive a tax credit for interest paid on student loans borrowed to pay for a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree in social work. There were concerns at the original hearing that there was the fiscal impact was too high.
Mm-hmm.
We've had the -2 amendment drafted, which reduces the maximum tax credit allowed for all groups. It reduces people working in an area with less than 10,000 people the maximum tax credit from 3,000 to 2,000. Those working in an area with a population with 10 to 100,000, this is reduced from 2,000 to 1,500, and those working in areas where there's a population over 100,000 from 1,000 to 500. There's also a -1 amendment, which is a simple housekeeping amendment. It adds a reference to ORS, which actually defines public body as it's used in the bill. This has a subsequent referral to finance and revenue.
Okay, the fiscal analysis is $482,618. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's an analysis done by someone at the State Board of Clinical Social Workers.
Okay.
Chair, my only question, and just on how things intersect, because there's a bill, I believe it's in education, that creates a loan program for lawyers, teachers, and social workers. And I'm just wondering what the nexus of that bill and this bill would be.
They will both end up in Ways and Means, right?
No, this goes through revenue.
Oh, this is revenue. Yeah, you're right. This is a tax.
And I'm assuming they both go there. So
They'll both go.
I'm just stating that for the record. Yeah. The purpose of the other bill was to kind of target folks in underserved areas, and like the lawyer part was for folks in the PD's office and issues like that. So, just for the record, curiosity that we have two bills that are kind of almost doing similar things, but...
Well, I would imagine in the Revenue Committee they would compare the bills and straighten it out.
Okay.
So.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 754.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 754. Seeing no objection, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment, Senate Bill 754.
You moved the dash.
Did we write that?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. That's this one.
Yeah, okay. We moved them both. Okay. Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 754. Seeing no objection, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 754 as amended to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. Do you want a recommendation?
Sure.
With a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 754 to the Committee on Revenue, Finance and Revenue with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Senator Montanison?
Excused.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Marquette?
Aye. Bill passes to Senate Revenue Committee.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question of the chair?
Yes.
Why haven't we been able to move this fast all session long? And I don't understand this. We could have been done in February.
Yeah, gee whiz. And
can we join in a song of We Have Amendments?
Yeah.
Great observations. Okay, we are now in
she just went to get Senator Walker.
Okay. Okay, I'll wait until Senator Walker comes down. We'll stand down for just a moment until Senator Walker gets here. These are all volunteer people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no compensation. I believe the way we drop it.
Well, except that I've been told that they require some compensation for people who have to travel. So I've been told there's another committee.
So you can't even do that?
Well, the brain injury. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. This would be what they would call a mandate bill. Don't you just love mandate bills?
Oh, we all love mandate bills. But we're not going to have a work session today.
Yeah, I understand that. I actually think this is a good mandate bill, and it's providing for hearing aids for children to be purchased under your insurance policy. Insurance policy, by and large, do not cover hearing aids for anyone. For seniors, it's a problem. But seniors sort of get by yelling a lot or not hearing a lot. And sometimes I think that's a choice they consciously make. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. At least my father-in-law made that statement several times. And then he got a hearing aid, and it was very expensive. It was $4,000. And We actually had conversations with them. It's quite pleasant. But my concern is for children who are learning to speak and learning to have conversations, learning to listen in school and hear their teacher, and they can't do that if they don't have hearing aids. Infants as young as 4 weeks old can be fit with amplification such as hearing aids and assistive devices. It's widely understood and accepted that hearing is critical for the development of speech, language, communication skills, and learning. And the earlier that hearing loss occurs in a child's life, the more serious the effect on the child's development. And in fact, that's why when I was in the House with Senator Cruz, we passed a bill to allow for newborn infant hearing screening so that we could determine when these children were born whether they had hearing problems at birth. And that's allowed us to really help children early on identify the need for hearing aid devices. So there are many options to assist in funding with these, but they're not all that great. Some private health care plans may cover the cost. Medicaid must cover the cost for children who qualify. And some IDEA funds, Children with Disabilities funds from the federal government, they will cover some audiology services. But basically, it's if you can get some benevolent organization. I know the Lions Club does eyeglasses, and I don't know some of the others if they provide for that. But they're very expensive. A basic hearing aid goes for $900. That's a lot of money. An advanced one, like my father-in-law had, as I mentioned, was $4,000. And when he passed away, we donated his hearing aid to a social service organization. There's newer, smaller ones. The children have to have different hearing aids as they grow because their body changes. And hearing aids last about 7 to 8 years. So for me, it was really important that we try to help these children be good learners and being able to participate in their families and at school. And that's why we're here today.
Do you have any idea how many children would be eligible?
I have no idea. My staff contacted three different audiologists, and they said that 10 to 20, hearing aids last about 10 to 20 years, and some people 7 to 8 years usually. Program through Voc Rehab Services for kids that pay for hearing aids, sometimes the schools, Lions Club sometimes raise money, but they don't indicate how many children per year would be impacted. That would be probably a fiscal determination.
Well, that was kind of a loaded question because I have the answer right in front of me.
What would that be?
Well, it says that OMIP, Oregon Medical Insurance Pool under DCBS estimates that 17 children would be eligible for hearing aid coverage. OMIP coverage, okay, that's for under OMIP.
Mm-hmm. The Oregon Medical
Oregon
Insurance
Medical.
Pool.
Now, down below, also it also mentions that PEB, the Public Employee Board, already cover that. There would be no fiscal impact as their plan already covers hearing aids for children, so mm-hmm. PEB insurance does. And the Department of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services indicates there would be no fiscal impact as Medicare programs would be excluded from the requirement. I don't know how many in the general population. The other thing is how many insurance companies already do this.
Well, the people that we interviewed said the most coverage you get is about $500 if you do get any coverage, but generally the plans do not. The comment from Audiology Associates in Portland was that the best plan is Intel's insurance. They pay as much as the contracted price, which is 20% of the price, because if you're looking at a very expensive hearing aid, that's a significant sum. He said United Healthcare may be around $500. It's not a lot of money that they're offering up to help these families. And so, you know, I know when I was on the campaign trail, I went to a door, and this mother's her daughter's glasses had broken. And she said, I had to not pay my light bill and my phone bill so that I could buy a pair of glasses for my daughter because she couldn't go without. Well, that was doable. It was a couple $100s, and that was doable. When you're looking at something that's $900 or $1,000, it's not so doable. And this bill actually came to me from my husband, who was watching a very interesting news story about children. And he said, there ought to be a law. And I said, okay, I'll fix it for you. So
far, so good. Okay.
We're not doing so good on the motorcycle training law, but we'll get that one next time.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator. Yes. Does this have anything to do with your ability to pay?
Your ability to pay?
Uh-huh.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, no. It just requires that health insurance plans provide them. There are some programs available for working adults who don't make very much money who can get some assistance. But like I said, it's very rare that you get that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Now, under this, the coverage would be 80% of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person enrolled would only pay 20%.
That's with OMAP.
That's correct.
But with CCIS, that would be, it doesn't say. It says that the annual premium increase would be $53,000 or approximately $100,000 per biennium. That's the city and county.
That it would, Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, it would cost the cities and counties $53,000 more in premiums to cover this? You know, many insurances don't cover orthodontia either. I know my husband's insurance did not at the time, so we put out a chunk of change for that. Orthodontists, they have a good gig going. I've never seen one of them turn somebody away saying they have straight teeth. But, you know, both my children had orthodontia, and we had to pay for that. It was about $3,000 apiece. But that was a choice we could have made not to do, because crooked teeth doesn't really hurt you too much. But if you can't hear, you've got a significant problem. You have a significant problem being able to learn and socialize.
Okay. Other questions? Seeing no other questions. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll scoot off to my other committee.
Close the public hearing, and you have your work cut out for you with my colleagues here. Thank you for
being
here.
I've been known to be persuasive, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. Ooh. Oh, Gina Ingram. I'm sorry. Is Gina Ingram? Oh. Genoa. I'm sorry. I'm going to open the public hearing on. I'm sorry, Genoa. Senate Bill 14. Genoa Ingram. You're here to support the bill, right?
Jim Morissette, Genoa Ingram, Oregon Academy of Audiology, and yes, we are here to support the bill. I'll be very, very brief. This is actually the only bill the Oregon Academy of Audiology has instructed me to testify on this legislative session. They support the bill for much the same reason as they support the cochlear implant bill. It is crucial to the development of children, and it's also crucial to their safety to be able to hear. And we believe, yes, there will be fiscal impact. We have not looked at the cost of the insurance companies. However, as with the cochlear implant bill, we believe that the benefits of, you know, helping a child grow into a productive and successful adult will offset those costs. And I want to just mention very briefly, the senator just referenced the infant hearing screening bill. That also was a bill that was brought forward by the Oregon Academy of Audiology. So they are very careful in what they support and their activity within the legislative setting. But those things that they choose to support, we believe, make a big difference in the lives of Oregonians, and we would urge your support.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Sorry. Yes. You know, the premise there is that if the child needs hearing aids, that no one's going to buy them. unless they're paid for by the insurance company. And that isn't necessarily true. In other words, saying that a child can't hear is and couldn't learn, and so that's true if they don't have a hearing aid. But this has no level of income. The front page of my local paper carried all the salaries in my locality on the coast in yesterday's paper. And I was very glad they put all of the state employees at the top because we were the lowest paid. But looking at the salary schedules of the people just in my local area, which doesn't compare with some of the other areas of Oregon, I would say that any one of them would be able to afford hearing aids for a child if they had one who needed it. So push back on that. I
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, first of all, I'd like to move down to your... No, I'm sorry. I understand, and the Oregon Academy of Audiology understands. If that is the compromise that needs to be reached for this bill to go forward so that those who aren't covered may benefit, we are more than happy to work with the proponents and with the committee members to make that happen. Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, we're interested in those children who cannot otherwise afford the hearing aids.
How would you make that happen?
Chair Morissette, we would be happy to work with the proponents to draft amendments that would set a reasonable level. I have not spoken with the proponents of the bill about that option, but we would rather do that than see the bill die.
You're talking about the people who cannot afford to do this independently and also do not have insurance?
Chair Morissette,
because they would have to have insurance.
Yes, Chair Morissette, what I understood Senator Berger's concern to be was that there were income levels for those people who could, if there were an income level, if there were a cap, that would address those individuals who could not afford hearing aid devices. You know, we're happy to work with audiologists and with the proponents of the bill to identify what a reasonable cap would be, and with Senator Berger as well.
Okay. Ms. Chair, children up to 180% federal poverty are Medicaid eligible.
Okay.
So we're dealing with about 200% federal poverty and above is the issue here. So.
Well, this is the business reality of it, Mr. Chairman, and that is that if you have a bill that requires all insurance policies to cover, they raise the price of everybody so that it will be able to cover that, and now we're covering children having hearing aids whose families are making $120,000 a year, and I just don't think that's fair to the other people that are paying into the insurance pool and money. So, I think that we want to provide for children whose parents are unable to provide for them, who need some type of hearing assistance. But I think to blanket it into all insurance policies is...
Can you make that happen?
Chair Morissette, I'm sure my business clients would be very happy if I could make that happen. And again, we're willing to work with Senator Berger, with Senator Cruz, because I know he has extensive background in this area, and the proponents of the bill to see what we can do to make it better.
You have until Monday.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would just point out that I believe, and it's so historically uncharacteristic of me, I've already voted for 3 insurance mandates this session. We're testing the limit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
For leaving the door open slightly. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll close the public hearing. Okay. Senate Bill 16. Senate Bill 16, we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 16. Why don't you tell us what the bill is about? And maybe has she been notified? Is she watching?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 16 changes the composition of the interdisciplinary team as related to coordinated hospice care. It indicates that a hospice program is considered to be licensed by the state, but is certified by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services and accredited by the Oregon Hospice Association, or if it is accredited by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. Requires hospice programs to provide utilization data to the Oregon Health Association and for Oregon Hospice Association to compile this data from all programs in the state and report to the DHS. Yes. You do have before you the Dash 1 amendments, which adds nurse practitioner to the list of providers who can be part of an interdisciplinary team providing hospice care. We actually just got, just now, the Dash 2 amendments, which is a small change on page 2, line 17. It just clarifies that licensure is considered to be accreditation, and so accreditation, I guess it's accreditation by the Oregon Hospice Association and certification by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Okay. And Senator Johnson, you're on.
Yes, sir.
We just got a reading of the bill plus the amendments, so we know most of the story, but you're here to fill us in on the rest.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of being a senator from District 16. And had I not been doing Senator Verger's work right this afternoon trying to help her district, I would not have arrived down here looking like I'm going to pass out. This bill came to my attention based on a recent experience that I have had with hospice. In my life, I've had two experiences with hospice, one very good and one not so good. I have had the privilege of knowing Ann Jackson for a long time. Prior to the commencement of the session, she and I had a long conversation about offering some legislation that would potentially address some holes in some of the statutes that cover hospice. And so it was with that in mind, and having recently been a family that was within the service of hospice, I agreed to bring the bill forward. Ms. Jackson has considerably more expertise on the text of the bill. I'm going to defer to her to share that with you. The amendment is a very modest change. It changes an or to an and I would commend the bill for your consideration.
Yes. Senator Cruz. Thank you for your work on the point.
Oh, that's exactly what I was doing.
I know, and it's such a good thing.
Well, and Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me to do a little work outside the context of this committee, I understand that important decisions have been made that would help move that project forward, and I just learned of them today, and that's why I was late, so I apologize. I was doing Senator Cruz's work too, Mr.
Oh,
Chair.
Oh, goodness gracious. Yeah. I thought it would be a slam dunk.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I want to express my deepest heartfelt appreciation to Senator Johnson for her having to rush to testify on the bill. And it is not because of that, but because of other issues, I am very persuaded that this is an extremely important bill. I think people have to realize that people are quite vulnerable and families are very vulnerable at the end of life. In my family situation, we were not serviced by hospice. However, I see the wisdom of this bill, and I will do everything I can to support more reporting, more training, more accountability that comes when people are almost at the mercy of those who are there to help them.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to Senator Verger without going into any of the details that, frankly, are still pretty raw for me to talk about. Anything that makes hospice work better, for all the reasons so eloquently articulated by the chair, is a good bill. I was faced with the situation of having some management issues with our second experience with hospice, which was not positive, wherein the hospice nurses, who I consider to the families just angels, were actually wasting time standing in lines at pharmacies, and that's a management issue that isn't isn't going to get addressed by this bill. But the Senator Verger put her finger on exactly why the accountability and the transparency is so important. I would consider myself a relatively sophisticated consumer of health care services. But at the end of life, when you're dealing with a loved one, rationality and the ability to go from point A to point B in a straight line is just overwhelmed by the grief and the anxiety and the sadness. And even the most sophisticated consumers are engulfed in a second guessing of yourself. And to have a hospice structure in place that guarantees not only quality medical care, but quality reinforcement to the family, going through probably the single worst thing that they're ever going to do, is absolutely imperative. And my less than stellar experience with hospice on the second time around, I think, should do nothing to diminish the fact that we have hospice available in our communities, that by and large the women, and it's largely the women, although I know there are gentlemen that do it, these people have a special calling to be able to do this kind of work. And I think it's incumbent upon the Oregon legislature to help them with clear rules that make their service, their compassionate care to Oregon families, at the highest quality that it can be. And so with that, I would just commend your consideration of this bill. Ms. Jackson will give you the particulars, and I will ask to be excused.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues.
Ann Jackson.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Ann Jackson, and I can begin before this starts here as well. I did bring a PowerPoint presentation because I thought you might be interested in seeing what hospice is like in Oregon and compare that. That really wasn't... So I'll just start here real quickly. First of all, I wanted to let you know that I am not a clinician. I have an MBA in not-for-profit management. I've been with the Oregon Hospice Associations nearly 20 years. I began the year after Oregon's unique hospice bills were passed in 1987, the first bills ever to be passed unanimously by both the House and the Senate. It is 84% of Americans would prefer to die at home if they had a life-threatening illness. I want to make sure that you understand that Oregon has been identified the leader in health in end-of-life care in Oregon. More than 50% of Americans, however, die in a hospital. Oregon's home hospice death rate, along with Utah's, is among the highest in the nation. Our hospital death rate is the lowest. The cost of care, of end-of-life care in Oregon, however, is the very lowest in the nation. And satisfaction surveys indicate that it doesn't matter how much you spend. The advanced planning rate in Oregon is the highest in the nation. When the POLST is in place, and I know that you've been hearing stories about why the POLST should be included, a POLST registry, respect for wishes is virtually 100%. The support study revealed in the mid-90s that what people said they wanted in an advanced directive had no bearing, no correlation with what it was they got. In Oregon, that is not true. 100% of Oregon's hospices use the POLST, Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. Morphine consumption, I know you've been hearing a bill also regarding monitoring laws. There is Oregon's prescribing laws are the least prescriptive and least restrictive in the nation at this time, and the morphine consumption rate is a crude indicator of physician willingness to prescribe strong medications. On the one hand, we have to balance concerns about drug abuse. On the other hand, we have to make sure that Oregonians and Americans have adequate pain management, which is an epidemic in the United States. Hospice penetrations in Oregon are among the highest in the nation, 57% in 2005. There's been a huge increase, as you can see in this slide depicting the time between 2000 and 2005, and this is one of the reasons why we are proposing additional requirements for hospices. I think that when you're looking at 80% penetration rates in hospice, that's a sign that maybe some people are getting hospice who probably shouldn't be. And, of course, 85% of people who receive hospice are of Medicare age. And so this is may not be the best way to use the public's money. This is another slide describing the increase in penetration. This is what Oregon looked like in 2003. Every Oregonian has access to hospice care. The pink and the red areas are excellent. And by 2005, the whole state would essentially be red. There are a few pockets. This green, the blue pocket up there was the new hospice that has just been established. But we do a very good job, as you can see here. This is what hospice looked like in 2003 in the United States. All of those blue areas indicate people are not having very good access to hospice and palliative care. As you can see, Oregon is very pink and red, doing a very good job. Some of the states in the South, however, increased dramatically and probably, again, perhaps inappropriately, and the OIG is looking at that. Hospice lengths of stay are impacted by regulatory scrutiny. We've been seeing some hospice lengths of stay at over 100 days. This is an issue that is also of concern to us that we're watching. And this, if you look at the yellow, blue, pink, and green areas across the top, those are the hospices that currently would not meet the standards that we are asking for in this bill. The yellow is Medicare only. All of the other programs, the orange, the red, the lavender, and the green, meet the requirements that we're proposing, which I will get to in a moment. Oregon has been identified as a leader in end-of-life care three times. The first time was in 1998 when the Death with Dignity was implemented. And, of course, at that time it was predicted that end-of-life care in Oregon was going to fall way down. And, in fact, that has not occurred. One of the conclusions I'd like to draw here is support of Oregon's hospice and the quality of care we provide is the very low number of people who actually use assisted dying in the state of Oregon. Regardless of whether you think the Death with Dignity Act is right, wrong, or you don't care, no one wants someone to use medication to end their lives if something can be resolved, and hospice has stepped up to the plate and is doing that. Here are some data sources. I've included in your packet a copy of that presentation. The bill itself, the primary thrust of the bill, is to make mandatory accreditation and certification. The bill, as it was drafted in 1987, gave hospices the option of either being accredited or certified as a program eligible to receive care and reimbursement under Medicare. At that time, there were only four hospices in the state that were certified under Medicare, which was first introduced in 1982. So it wasn't a very long time. 22 programs were accredited by the Oregon Hospice Association. There was a big concern at that time. Most of the hospices in Oregon were volunteer programs, and there was something disrespectful about considering accepting payment for care. However, it costs a lot of money to provide high-quality care at the end of life and a lot of resources, and being reimbursed for services is very important, and, of course, hospice is included in the Oregon Health Plan. So that's the first thing. There are a couple of other provisions. One of them would, that in One of them would establish hospices as an institution for purposes of Chapter 146. 146 is the Death Investigations Code, which was developed in 1970 before hospice was even developed. Hospice actually is an institution. It takes the care to the patient as opposed to the patient going to the care. And so most of these laws were written primarily towards hospitals and institutions, which at that time were considered to be long-term care facilities, nursing facilities. We believe that the county district attorney, some of the others, there's inconsistency in how they interpret 146. Some of them require that all hospice deaths be reported. Some of them have gone out and investigated hospice deaths, which is a travesty. We want to establish that hospice is an institution. All hospice patients have an attending physician. All hospice patients have a life-threatening limited life expectancy. And all of their deaths, any deaths that would be suspicious, of course, would continue to be reported. But this just shifts that in there and would remove that inconsistency from county to county. A second one is adding nurse practitioners. Nurse practitioners are accepted in the state of Oregon. They just were not included in this law, so this is a housekeeping measure. Another one is that we would, this would be equivalent to licensure, people who met the provisions of this law. Oregon's law is very different. Most states rely on traditional licensure for hospices. Their licensure laws are based on Medicare certification. Oregon has broadened that, so we already have additional oversight. The conditions of participation for Medicare will be changed in May, and they have these additional requirements for quality assurance and performance indicators. We are ahead of the pack right now. We'd like to stay that way. But one of the things that I hear when I'm traveling around the country is that Oregon doesn't have a hospice licensure law. Oregon's hospices are very well regulated. Our law has been very effective. It has been so effective and finally is being recognized that even the state of Colorado now is developing accreditation standards. I've been providing them with technical consultation for that. And the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization is considering an accreditation program. Accreditation is a little bit different. Currently under Medicare, hospice programs may be surveyed only once every 8 years. That just isn't enough. With OHA accreditation, they're surveyed every 2 years. With Joint Commission accreditation, they're surveyed every 3 years. And we think that should be the rule as opposed to an option.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess based on your testimony, you say where we're falling short is in Medicare and Medicaid, and their certification isn't an adequate standard. You say they're going to adjust it. I'm wondering why that's even relevant if we're looking at accreditation by the Hospice Association or JCO. I mean, that's, according to what you're saying, that's the golden rule at this point in time, correct?
Every hospice to receive reimbursement must be certified. So
I understand
right.
that. Right.
So what we are doing is adding a mandatory requirement for the accreditation.
For accreditation. Okay.
It's now an optional. But as I said, 3/4 of the hospice programs already are so interested in quality that they're looking at that. But there are a few coming in, and there are new ones. They don't always have experience, and that's where there have been most of the problems, most of the complaints that I get.
Okay, so the basic change where the law is now, if you're certified, you qualify. And with
for this, money.
Yeah, but for accreditation, it's either got to be the Hospice Association accreditation
right.
or JCO.
Right.
And the Medicare, Medicaid thing, you pretty much got to do because that's where a lot of your money is going to come from.
Right.
So, okay.
And I want you to know that the Board of Directors, this the recommendation for this law came out of our accreditation surveyors who are seeing more, having more concerns when they're going into hospices, putting their fingers in there and looking at what's happening. By me, I receive complaints about hospices, which used to be a result of mostly misunderstandings. Now they're having a little more substance.
Okay, can you follow up?
Yes.
Is there much substantive difference between the accreditation standard of the Hospice Association and JACO, or are they pretty much mirrored of each other?
A joint commission is required of all hospitals that medical centers that have hospice programs. The Oregon Hospice Association began as a group of minimal, but now is going for optimal standards. We measure hospices against National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization standards, which is the gold standard, or some of them. The hospices are choosing quality indicators against which they wish to be measured because quality is the issue for them as well.
I guess, Mr. Chair,
it's two different things. JACO right. is a different
I understand
kind of
that.
Thing. But we can also measure hospices against JACO standards. We're far cheaper than JACO is, for one thing.
I understand they're two separate things.
Right.
My question is, as far as quality assurance, are they relatively similar?
Yes.
Okay.
We do not believe that hospices need to be both. There are several of them that are.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the slide on morphine consumption
yes.
for 100,000,
mm-hmm.
Everyone who's going to be licensed to do hospice has that training in the area of the adequate amount of drugs that can be administered?
Hospice is probably the gold standard on pain management. But what we sometimes see is that physicians will wait until their patients are in hospice care before they prescribe adequately. When you have the whole hospice team backing you up, then you're more likely to get medications, but it really is very sad that anyone should have to wait until they're dying before they get their pain managed. Like, chronic pain is an issue in this country, and there's always this thing in the back of a doctor's mind before they prescribe. You know, do they want this because they want the high, or do they want this because they have legitimate pain? And I think there's certainly a lot of people whose lives are revolving around whether or not they can get the adequate pain management.
Mr. Chairman, I have a follow-up there.
Yes.
So right now we are relatively high, but we're still way behind Arizona.
Actually, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
We're not that far behind. Arizona is a newcomer okay. into this. Oregon is among the top 10, even though it looks like we're way behind. I did
right.
not put the whole report down there. And it fluctuates. It's measuring the buys. There is also, every state has a different utilization. Some states are more likely to be prescribing oxycodone. Oregon is one of those that's more likely to be prescribing methadone for pain management because it's cheaper. Methadone and morphine are cheaper, and oxycodone is more expensive. So there will be differences.
Mr. Chairman, just the main point I'm getting at is that right now it appears to me that we don't have folks that are terminal who are not getting adequate pain management. They're getting the pain management they need.
If they're in hospice, they better be. I'm the one who makes the promises for the hospices, and then I leave it to them to carry it out. But yes, hospice should be able to adequately manage pain. From time to time, you're going to find a patient who is going to choose to have some pain to maintain their lucidity.
Senator Berger.
Yes, well, I'll just make a comment about that. I don't know why anybody would be too worried
about addiction when a person's life is just
isn't that just, you know, and
so it, absurd.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Senator.
Yes, you're absurd. Right.
I just throw my hands up at these things.
To me that doesn't bear common sense.
No.
I want to ask you a question that is not covered in this bill, but I want to know this. Can hospice workers or administrators inherit? Can they be the recipients of those whom they have cared for in their last hours?
Hospices all have policies regarding this, and no, they should not be. They should, certainly, there are people who want to give back to hospices, and yes, that is possible to do that. If there appears to be any coercion, from time to time there might be a hospice worker, I think I've run across three instances in the last 20 years where a patient wants to marry their hospice worker and give them all their money. Those are things to be discouraged, but yes, hospices can be bequests, and the Oregon Hospice Association is been the recipient of some bequests over the years. But
the entity is not the people.
Hmm?
The entity is not the people is what you're saying.
No.
Okay.
No, it's not any hospice worker.
That's my next question. It's not Jane Smith. It's the hospice.
The hospice program.
Program.
And hospice programs do rely on public support.
Yeah.
And certainly most of our, only 10% of our funding comes from membership dues, incidentally. We are a public benefit organization and act like one. And of course, with these responsibilities, with this law, we need to maintain that arm's length relationship.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question. Who would know? Who would supervise? Who would regulate if there's an individual working in hospice who continues over and over to inherit? Would you have to have a whistleblower?
Usually there's a family member or there's somebody who's going to, Oregon really is a very small state. It's very unlikely that these things are going to be go unnoticed.
Okay.
This is one of the reasons why I think the reporting of the state is very reliable as far as the Death with Dignity Act goes on. Somebody, if something went wrong, there'd be somebody to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know,
all right.
And we have hospices in every community.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 16.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 16. Comments, concerns, hearing none, so move.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 16.
Senator Cruz moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 16. Comments, concerns, seeing none, so move.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 16 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 16 as amendment to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Monahan.
Excused.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator
Ford. Aye. Senator Morissette. Aye. Senate Bill 16 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Johnson will carry the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Close the work session, and we are adjourned.